You're listening to RTE Lyric Live from the West Cork Chamber Music Festival.
The opening of John Kinsella's most recent symphony, Number 10, with the excellent Irish Chamber Orchestra and Jörg Wittmann directing. We met John Kinsella, who's just turned 80, in Dublin during the week in the National Concert Hall. Our first question to John was, the 10th symphony, it's very compact, it's very dramatic, but it's very compact, very classical in style and in size. Why?
These are things one decides to do from time to time, you know, and I've gone through phases where I've written for everything in the kitchen sink, if you like, and a piece called A Selected Life, which is a setting of a poem about Sean O'Riordan, put harpsichords, string quartets, everything you like. And that's what I wanted to do at that time, choirs, soloist speakers, everything. And my Eighth Symphony was very heavily scored, and it's a very, very long piece in one movement, 45 minutes, so it was a huge effort. And I couldn't see myself writing another symphony after that, but the Irish Chamber Orchestra asked me to do a piece for them, and that led to the Ninth Symphony, which was for strings. And in the meantime, I became conscious of the fact that the classical orchestra is a unique thing that has a tremendous strength in it, and that strength can be sapped by adding to it. If you look at Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, it has just two horns, double wind, timps, nothing else, and that's one of the glories of music. So therefore, if one is writing a symphony nowadays, it's quite legitimate to try and follow that track and see what one can do with those means, which are still, if you like, just pregnant with multiple opportunities for the imagination. And it also has the that particular combination also has the ability to be very mobile. You can switch and you can accelerate things in a way that a much larger orchestra in tutti might not be able to achieve. So you're talking about something like a string quartet with additions and then extra strings around it. So if one thinks in that way, it's a very lithe, mobile, healthy kind of sound.
The three-movement structure, was that intentional right from the very beginning, or did that just evolve as the piece was composed?
Yeah, it's a very good question indeed, insofar as it wasn't intended to be a three-movement work. I very rarely lay down very clear parameters for what I'm trying to do. On occasions I do and stick to them, but in this case I was full sure it was going to end up as a one-movement piece. And then the, if you like, motto theme on the clarinet inserted itself into the music and asserted itself. And it took over, and it was responsible for having to stop at various stages and comment and change the mood. So that's what led me into three separate movements, because the clarinet, I wanted to finish one section and then it was to comment on what had gone before and lead you into what was coming afterwards. So my intention was one movement, but that's the way it divided up, and the clarinet was responsible for that.
You must have known, in my opinion, John, you must have known at that stage then that you were onto something, if you know what I mean, that you were following a star, following something, because when the material starts telling you where it's going rather than you telling it, Surely that's a very exciting thing for a composer.
Well, it's very exciting, yeah, and it does take over. It's a bit like getting used to a new child in the family. You know, at the beginning, it has monumental effects on your daily life, but as regards communicating or being somebody, it gradually takes over and then begins to feed into you, and then you begin to interact, and then you create something between the two of you. So the material is like a child which is growing and can take over at times and give mobility to what you're doing.
Your symphony number one, it dates from much later in your life, but if we can we also digress and talk about some of your influences before it, John, if you know what I mean. Actually long before it in some ways, but when you were much more established as John Kinsella composer rather than John Kinsella Tyro, whom Arnold Bax doesn't like for whatever reason. And again, I've read that some of your inspirations and influences at the time were the likes of Pierre Boulez and Karlheinz Stockhausen. And what was it in those composers that so attracted you at the time, John?
Well, they were very much of their day, but like in my own personal case, I tried to study composition and harmony and counterpoint and things like that, and I just simply got bored with what I was finding out, and it was absolutely leading nowhere and was proving it an anti-stimulus to whatever I was looking for. And I subsequently got in touch with a Welsh composer who'd written a book on dodecaphonic music, and this was by correspondence, so we had quite an exchange for a while, and that led me into thinking about that serialism was the way to start loosening up the thoughts and finding a way to put order on the notes rather than studying romantic harmony. And most of the textbooks I'd studied on romantic harmony were more full of things you could not do rather than things that you could do. And it was terribly negative, the whole thing. Subsequently, I found Hindemith's book on harmony up to the time of Brahms. And that's a very thin volume and tells you all the things you can do. It doesn't say what you can't do. And it's the way to study if you want to go down that particular road. So I got bogged down in that whole area, and I found that the 12-tone system was something that one could comprehend and manipulate, and a lot of my compositions were based on that. But I then got fed up with that because, in a sense, that it was too arbitrary. And like an awful lot of people since, that they use the influence of serialism as just one colour in their palette. But it gives you the freedom to get away from the way harmony had progressed up to the time of Wagner and that, and where it was on the verge of breaking down entirely as a language. So it's very much a pick and mix nowadays.
Another inspiration, I believe, that I've read, that was, you know, and inspiration is the word, in my opinion, it was Bartok and the string quartets in particular. They had an impact on you.
They had a huge impact, yeah. I studied those very closely. And they opened up such a huge range of possibilities in a form that one thinks of as perhaps limited to some extent. But he added 500, 1,000% to the language of the string quartet. And in the course of doing so, with his kind of rhythmic drive and the total fancy of his music, his night music, things like that, and then the very strict finales, it was just a whole new world that one could learn a huge amount from, really.
In a sense, I mean, I love Bartok, so I'm like yourself, so I don't mind, I think he's great, but he is the big granddaddy of Ligeti and Penderecki and people like that, because he seems to open the door and they pour through. In similar fashion, they seem to be able to take elements of Bartok and use it to their own ends, particularly Ligeti, in my opinion. Did you find in your love of, you know, discovery in Bartok, did you find him opening up worlds for John Kinsella?
Funnily enough, no. Even though, the study of his music and the string quartets in particular had a profound effect on me, and the concerto for orchestra had a profound effect, insofar as at the time it was written, which I think was around 1945, it spoke in a language that one could comprehend and said something wonderful. So it pointed a way to freedom, to escape from this limited language, even though it predated a lot of what happened. It still was a huge pointer that one could go back to and say, yes, you're not limited to a totally cerebral style of music, and you can actually say things and sing things and build large structures.
So in this sense, we're moving now towards your symphony number one, which has great energy and great forward momentum. And I've been listening to it in the last 2 days, and I keep hearing, and I mean this as a compliment, I keep hearing the young Beethoven and the young Walton in it. The same kind of, you know, exuberance that courses through Walton's first symphony. It reminds me of. Now, I'm not saying, oh yeah, you took down Walton's, you know, not at all. But did you have any specific models in mind? Because this was, in a sense, your symphony number one.
Yes. Well, again, there was a slight element of happenstance, if you like, in this circumstance as well. Because I wrote the first movement and called it Essay for Orchestra. And sometime later, Albert Rosen was looking at the score and he played through it once. And he said, you know, that sounds like the first movement of a symphony. And I took him up on that, and that's how the work grew from there. I sort of saw what he meant and added the other three movements, and it ended up as my longest symphony. All the others have been shorter, so I'm learning something.
It's funny you should mention Rosen. I mean, I remember hearing him when I was younger here, when he was conducting the orchestra. Because he's also, the performance that I got out of the RT archives this week, he's also with the RT National Symphony Orchestra in your second symphony. Yes. And I'm just wondering, one, John, was the second one more difficult to write? Because, see, you've done it now. And it's like the second night for an actor. The first night, they're full of nerves, so they're great. The second night is, I can do this. Does that make it more difficult? And then thirdly, when I have been listening to it, it has many colours and many moods, but the thing I keep honing in as a listener is the exuberance. Rosen and the orchestra seem to be having a hell of a time with it. Did you end up writing for them, if you know what I mean, in the best sense of the word? Because they seem to be really going for it.
I dare say there was something of Albert Rosen in it, yeah, although not consciously, if you like, but I was close to him at the time. And the whole Czech school of playing music and Czech orchestral music is something that still makes the hair stand on the back of my neck when you hear the real style, which he was a proponent of. And there must have been something in that when I knew I was writing and Albert was going to conduct. And I put four trumpets in, which I would never do again. You know, but that was part of the exuberance, if you like, you know. I found it too much within the context of the whole orchestra, but I'm not saying it's wrong, but it was part of a kind of heady time. And during that time, I retired from RTE. So part of that symphony was written as part of my new context when I went it alone as a composer. And
So a sense of release, perhaps, as well, if you know what I mean. Because now you're not.
There were very heady days. Mm. Yeah, fantastic. I remember in the early days when I devoted my mornings, didn't have to go anywhere and devoted my mornings to writing music. I'd head off for a walk at about 30 miles an hour, you know, feeling in tremendous form, uplifted.
High as a kite, if you like. Yeah, elated, I mean.
Yeah, totally elated. Of course, that doesn't last forever either. Yeah. We're all human.
No. If I may slightly digress again, and let's talk a little bit about craft and routines, approaches, and actually this is quite close to walking at 30 miles an hour elated around Dublin 16 or whatever it is. But first of all, John, do you actually have a composing routine?
I did have a very strict routine at that time because I had the energy for it. And it was to write in the morning and revise in the afternoon. Basically, that was it, and do that every single day through as many weekends as I could as well. So when you stick to a routine like that in any human activity, you can see how the stuff builds up. And it's also good in that the ideas don't languish, that you keep them on the move all the time. And you build a whole momentum into your work. And once you go beyond the halfway mark or reach a significant point in the work, it becomes much easier because you can see what you're heading for now. And it can be just a wonderful experience, really, you know, when you get to that stage.
And so we're at your desk, if you like. We're not, but let's just imagine we're at your desk. You've invited us in and we're very quiet. And you're working away on, you know, say, the 11th symphony. That'll be, hopefully, the next one. Will there be a keyboard on your right or left-hand side? Will you be playing something into Sibelius on a computer? Will there be a guitar? Or will there be nothing? Do we have to look into your head to hear what's going across the page?
Well, my working situation is I have a piano on my left-hand side and I have a table, like a desk on right angles to it. I don't use spades.
Okay.
No, I just use a pencil and rubber and get my own paper photocopied to the way I want it and clear all that away so that you can write with ease and you're not bogged down in details. But I think one of my great virtues is I can't play the piano, but I use it for what I need and it doesn't get in my way at all.
Okay.
I simply have a blank page, pencil and rubber and a ruler, and that makes life very easy, really.